to me.
None of the things you say. Talk to me. Talk to me. In your own special way. That's right. Welcome, New Mexico, around the country and around the world, if you're listening. Welcome to Dialogue, KSFR's Friday evening talk show, where the conversation starts with you. I'm your host, MK. I'd like to begin every broadcast with a huge thank you for listening this week and or any week. I always consider it an honor to have you join me and take the time out of your busy lives to give me a listen. It means the world to me, and I can always only hope it means as much to you. And joining me is Dr. Chuck Ruby, Executive Director of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry. So, Chuck, if we can begin by getting your take on the president's address in regard to mass shooting and what your response to that was.
Sure. My understanding is the president is calling for a response to these mass shootings in terms of identifying the hate and mental illness that is involved or associated with it. I really think that while focusing on hate in our culture is a very noble thing and something that we should put some effort into to change the popular landscape, the idea of focusing on mental illness is a red herring. There's a couple reasons for that. First and foremost, I think, is that mental illness, that phrase that we use, mental illness, doesn't refer to some kind of defective process that is inherent in a person and that makes that person do things such as shooting. Instead, the phrase is the label we give to people who do things that we otherwise don't understand, especially horrific things like the mass shootings.
And I'm sorry, I just want to be clear. So when you say the phrase, are you saying the term mental illness?
Yes.
Does that?
The phrase mental illness, it's a label that the mental health industry assigns and that lay people assign to others who do things that are problematic and for which we don't understand why they've done it.
So. However, I think there's a lot of people out there who believe that these are diseases. I mean, these are brain diseases. This is what we've been told. So
correct.
That it's
that's the prevailing view. Unfortunately, there is absolutely no scientific evidence that's ever been presented in the 200 years or so since psychiatry kind of became a profession to demonstrate that these behaviors and experiences that we observe among people aren't caused by some kind of defective bodily brain or mind process.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know there's a lot of people that would take issue with that because I think what you're saying sounds kind of would be shocking to most people or a lot of people in that it's sort of common knowledge these days. We see brain scans, we see study after study in our literature, the literature and information we read across the board in every direction that these are diseases. It seems to be an established fact. So how do you argue against that plethora of information that's out there or how can you argue against that level of information?
Well, by the way, when I first entered this profession in the 90s, I was shocked when I eventually discovered after I had received my doctoral training and licensing, I was shocked when it dawned on me that there was no scientific evidence. And I'll get into why the issues that you raised that's not really scientific evidence. So for instance, brain scan research does in fact show that the brains of people who have been diagnosed with certain kinds of mental disorders look different than the brain scans of people who haven't been diagnosed with those mental disorders. But we have to remember that those brain scans are not revealing brain pathology. They are merely revealing brain differences. And it is commonsensical that if one person lives a certain kind of life in a chronic fashion, let's say depression, so they're chronically passive, they're disinterested in life, sad a lot, their brain is going to look different than someone who isn't experiencing that. that difference in brain functioning isn't the same as brain disease or brain pathology or brain malfunctioning or anything like that. So, for instance, a person who plays the piano and has played the piano over years and years, their brain scan looks different than one who doesn't play the piano. But we would never conclude from that playing pianos is a disease in some time, or that brain pathology causes people to play pianos. So that's the problem in the logic with this reasoning about brain scans and brain differences, and by the way, even further, genetic differences, which do exist among people who have been diagnosed with mental disorder and those who haven't been. Those genetic differences are not the same as genetic pathology.
So I'm trying to follow your logic. So it isn't that there isn't differences in those brains, although I would think some people might say, well, but if that's a tendency over a lifetime, couldn't that almost become a disease in a sense, or a pathological tendency of that brain to move in that direction? But I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, I think what you're referring to is maybe a habit. And yes, I mean, habit is a real thing. When we live our lives, we do so largely out of habit, not conscious awareness a lot of the time. And if we have a habitual pattern of behaving and thinking, we are likely to continue that habitual pattern into the future. That's why one of the best predictors of future violence by people is past violence, episodes of past violence. Habit is hard to change. And so that pattern will continue, but habit and pattern isn't the same as disease. So, you know, to be a disease, there has to be some kind of evidence, scientific evidence, of pathology, some kind of damage, some kind of malfunctioning of the bodily systems involved. So, and that is what has yet to be shown in any of the research that tries to discover that.
So it's the pathologizing of the difference that you have a problem with.
Exactly. And again, there's lots of analogies, not just piano playing, but people who read Braille, their brains look differently than people who don't. If I raise my left arm, it looks differently from someone who raises their left leg. The brain just reacts as it's structured to react based on what we do. And over time, there's a thing called brain plasticity, that the brain can actually change in structure based on that chronic pattern of behaving. But again, the brain plasticity changes, the brain neurotransmitter changes, the differences in neurochemicals, different pathways that are activated in the brains when we're doing certain things. That's not the same thing as pathology or disease or illness. It's just how our brains work when we do these things. So it's a, you know, again, as I said, it's a red herring. Those kinds of studies that are presented purportedly to show that mental illness is a true disease are without foundation.
So therefore, you're saying that people can actually get better, can change because of brain plasticity, they can actually change and heal from their tendency, what would be shown as on a brain scan as more of a habitual tendency, but that they can actually grow out of that by learning different techniques, and how does medication play into that?
Yes, people can change, but your use of the word heal, I think, is problematic. It perpetuates the idea that it's an illness. Because if not an illness, there's nothing to heal. But if you say it metaphorically, I get that we can change the ways that we live. And I think most people know that because we've done it all. The only reason the previous ways hadn't been described as a mental illness is because you never went to a mental health professional to get help for that problem. Because if you did, you all of a sudden become mentally ill because you'll get a diagnosis, and that's the basis of what mental illness means, at least conventionally. So there are lots and lots and lots of people out there who, if they sought out help, would all of a sudden become mentally ill because they get diagnosed when they seek out help. It's not because they have an illness. So yes, I think you and I know I've had experiences where I have made substantial changes to the ways that I behave, to the ways that I think about things, what my goals are. And those changes that I made were accompanied by neural changes in my brain. That if we were to do an MRI on my brain during that time, we would see a change. Psychiatric drugs, actually, the ironic thing is they actually create a chemical imbalance in the brain, and that can be seen, that would be seen given the right technology, when psychiatric drugs are used to so-called treat people who have been diagnosed with mental illnesses. Basically, what they're doing is either sedating or stimulating the person psychoactively. Most of the time, it's sedation. And so the person ends up not being able to notice emotional fluctuations, which is what it's intended to do, just like, say, alcohol does. So they don't notice the emotional fluctuations, and therefore they don't react with problematic behaviors that would be called mental illness. But what's going on in the brain is the brain's normal status of neurochemical activity is being disrupted artificially by a toxic substance. And in the process, the brain compensates for that foreign substance. And over time, the brain gets way out of whack in terms of the chemical imbalance because it's constantly trying to fight against the artificial effect of the psychiatric drug. That's why when you stop taking psychiatric drugs abruptly, or when you stop drinking alcohol abruptly, or stop doing marijuana abruptly, or whatever drug it is, you have terrible withdrawal symptoms, and some of which can be fatal.
So I just want to kind of wrap up quickly. The real problem you have is with the approach that we're taking toward so-called mental illness, and then the treatment to a disease that in your mind, or what you've come to discover, is not really a disease, and therefore now we're treating something that doesn't even actually exist, but perhaps creating more problems than might have existed to begin with. Am I getting that right?
Yes, I don't get me wrong. I don't think these problems that we call mental illness aren't problems. They're big problems, very serious problems, like the mass shootings. But even depression, anxiety, PTSD, those terms are used to describe very serious problems. They're just not illnesses, and so a medical approach to dealing with them is not appropriate and, in fact, is harmful.
If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Dr. Chuck Ruby, Executive Director of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry. So can you talk a bit more about the psychiatric drugs and their effect and why you're concerned about them in terms of mass shootings in particular?
Well, because as I said, psychiatric drugs mess up brain chemistry. They prevent the brain from working the way that it is structured to work. So they create the chemical imbalance. Some of the experiences that people have who are taking psychiatric drugs, and I can tell you a personal story. I briefly took Paxil about 20 years ago when I was retiring from the military and I was having a difficult time transitioning. I kind of knew about the problems with this at that time, but I just thought I'd give it a try. The experience I had was incredibly awful. It was the strangest feeling because I felt nothing and I didn't like the fact that I didn't feel anything. And I was I was not concerned at the least about any consequences of what I did. I luckily decided to stop taking that drug after some days, and that resolved. I hadn't taken it enough so that I would experience withdrawal symptoms, apparently, because I didn't. But that feeling I experienced, I can understand how if you have that feeling, and then you have other psychosocial stressors going on in your life, serious ones, like you are rejected by your coworkers or your peers, or you're socially isolated, or you have a bankruptcy, or your spouse leaves you. Given that combination of experience, it is quite understandable how someone could strike out in anger, in frustration, violently. And so that's my concern, is that these psychiatric drugs, because they're thought to be medicines treating true illnesses when they're not, they are chemicals that are disrupting brain activity so the person isn't able to notice emotional fluctuation. They create a state in that person that is It's akin to someone going out and getting very, very drunk. And when they do that, they are more likely to lash out impulsively because of the effect of the drug. So I think that psychiatric drugs ought to be thought of as just like any other kind of chemical substance that has psychoactive effects. And those substances are clear in the research that chemical substances, the use of chemical substances, increases one's risk of being violent.
So, and yet I have to say that's quite violent. I mean, to go out and kill 20 people is not just a small bout of violence. It's unimaginable rage, right? So, and just unimaginable to most of us in any form, any fashion. Do we know how many of the mass shooters have actually been taking these meds and or undergone psychiatric treatment?
I can tell you that many of them, and I've seen lots of statistics about this, different sources. There's one source online called SSRIstories.org, and it purports to list a running account of all violent acts like these, and the indicating the drug that the person was taking at the time. And in looking at those, reviewing those, most of those at SSRI Stories include people who are taking psychiatric drugs. Many of them are on some kind of psychiatric chemical when they do the shooting, or they're withdrawing from the chemical when they do the shooting. So I think that in of itself is an alarm bell that tells us we ought to look at the possible role that psychiatric drugs play in these incidents. Because you know well as I do, is if we found that every person or most people who committed mass shootings were taking oxycodone, there would be a national outrage about the prescription of oxycodone to people around the country.
Right. Well, but that's a pretty extreme claim to make, right? To say that these drugs are causing, or partially even causing, these mass shootings or mass shooters to behave in the way that they are. But is there evidence there to back that?
Yes, as I said, one of the, I don't think it's
because
outrageous.
It's not just a little violent. We're talking massively violent.
Right, and I'm not saying that in these mass shootings, psychiatric drugs is the one thing that made it all happen. Not at all. There are multiple risk factors involved in any kind of violent act, to include these kind of really extreme violent acts. In fact, if it's so extreme, it stands to reason there would be many factors involved. But there are lots and lots of things. So a person's past history of violence is a risk factor for their for future violence. If the person has difficulty controlling their thought processes, meaning they're very, very upset, and their thoughts seem to race, that is a risk factor. If the person is feeling mistreated or persecuted by someone, and most all these shooters do have a history of being ostracized in some way or mistreated, and their sense of revenge is involved in striking back against those who they feel are worthy of punishment. But the psychiatric drug issue is in there too, because it has been long known that the use of any kind of chemical substance to cope with stress, especially habitually, increases one's risk of committing violent acts. ICEP is not necessarily an anti-psychiatric drug organization by any means. We do understand psychiatric drugs as fundamentally chemicals, just like any other kind of chemical, such as illicit drugs, recreational drugs, alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, any kind of psychoactive drug. In other words, it has an effect on one's consciousness. It's conscious altering, and it is quite clear from the research on violence that the use of drugs and alcohol of any type increases one's risk of committing violent acts. In addition to that general statement, a lot of the so-called side effects of psychiatric drugs include violence, either toward oneself or other people, and that finding is reported by the drug companies themselves and their randomized clinical trials that they do to try to establish the FDA rules on bringing a drug to market. The body knows nothing about prescription status, legal status. All it does is react to the psychoactive property of those drugs. And so psychiatric drugs ought to be included in that. There are many psychiatric drugs, many prescription drugs that used to be illicit drugs. So, for instance, right now we're prescribing ketamine, marijuana, ecstasy. There's research on LSD to be used as, quote, medicine. And so this difference that most people see between illicit drugs and medicines is a false difference. They're all just chemicals.
Heroin, cocaine, morphine, all have their roots in the medical system.
Yeah, heroin used to be prescribed for cough and cold.
Right.
So cocaine was prescribed for toothache pain on children. I mean, you know, there's this mix of the two classes of chemicals. They're all the same. They're all chemicals. One's not safer than the other.
Why do you think this is not being talked about as an issue?
Money. There is a tremendous amount of financial interest in the mental health industry continuing as it is. The financial interest by these organizations, I think, is why there's so much resistance to question the prevailing model of mental health and mental illness. It's been estimated there are two lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry for every member of Congress. Billions are made each year by pharmaceutical companies in selling psychiatric drugs. It's the same reason it took so long to get any kind of attention paid to the overprescription of opioids. But, you know, a better example would be if we found that people who were doing ecstasy or marijuana were committing these acts. Because those are illicit, there would be a lot more attention paid to it, and we would consider it part of the war on drugs and so on and so forth. But you saw that with the opioid epidemic, it took a while for pharmaceutical industry, the government, to get around to paying attention to this. I'm not really sure they're paying sufficient attention to it as it is, but at least it's increased attention. So that's why I think with psychiatric drugs, we're not getting much attention paid to this, because there's a lot of money involved. The pharmaceutical industry makes billions a year on selling psychiatric drugs, which, by the way, depends on the idea that mental illness is really a disease, because if people would realize it's not a disease, even though it's a problem, it wouldn't make sense to take drugs to take care of the problem. But I think that's the biggest thing, the money involved, the lobbying efforts that the pharmaceutical industry has put forth on Capitol Hill. There's a lot of subsidiary organizations that whose existence depends on the use of psychiatric drugs and the idea of mental illness as real illness, such as the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, the other member organizations, grassroots organizations like NAMI are really dependent on the existence of this myth, as I would call it. I mean, these pharmaceutical companies also, as you know, they advertise everywhere, direct advertising to consumers on television, radio, internet, and so forth. The United States is the only country other than New Zealand that allows that kind of advertising direct to consumer. Through television ads, TV, print, internet, so forth. But that encourages people to go to their doctor and just ask for the drug they think would be best. And usually when that happens, they get it. The main news outlets are dependent on their sponsors. And we also know that pharmaceutical companies are some of those sponsors. And they're not going to want to upset those sponsors. The main message being pushed by all sides is that mental illness causes violence, because what that does is it avoids having to deal with gun control issues, which the right doesn't want to do. But it then provides this narrative about what we can do to try to reduce violence. What it's going to do, if that succeeds, and if people who have been designated mentally ill are somehow monitored for potential violence, or maybe even prophylactically treated so they won't commit violence, it's just going to increase the risk of more violence. Because, again, it would be an example of mistreating someone, and being mistreated increases one's risk of violence. But I do know that many, many, many of them are on some kind of psychiatric chemical when they do the shooting, or they're withdrawing from the chemical when they do the shooting. So I think that in of itself is an alarm bell that tells us we ought to look at the possible role that psychiatric drugs play in these incidents.
And we need to take a break, so we'll be back after these short messages. And joining me is Dr. Chuck Ruby, Executive Director of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry. If, in fact, these drugs are causing violent behavior, by just focusing on it being a problem due to mental illness is causing the violence, does that then get the pharmaceutical company off the hook from having to look at the effect of their drugs?
Yes, definitely. It's said that it's the disease that causes the violence, not the treatment for the disease. So in using a medical model approach to these things, that's how you would articulate it. It's a red herring. Those kinds of studies that are presented purportedly to show that mental illness is a true disease are without foundation. If you don't use a medical model approach, like we don't, you would say this person is experiencing some very real life problems that's causing a lot of emotional turmoil. The psychiatric drug isn't a treatment to that, and that's not a disease. The psychiatric drug is nothing more than like how we use alcohol. The way they're marketed, the way they're portrayed as medicines, when in fact they're not medicines, they're just drugs, chemicals, gets the pharmaceutical company off the hook in terms of the popular idea of these drugs contributing to violence, because the popular idea is that these drugs are medicines. And how could medicine be problematic? It's helping. That's the story.
But in fact, you all are concerned that it may be causing some of the violent behavior.
Right, and when psychiatric drugs are used to so-called treat people who have been diagnosed with mental illnesses, basically what they're doing is either sedating or stimulating the person psychoactively. There's never been a good attempt to, a good scientifically structured and designed study long-term to try to get at causation.
Now, also there was mention from Trump, he wanted to increase the need for mandated treatment and involuntary commitment. What is your response to that?
I think it's a big mistake. The treatment that they typically get is not going to change their propensity to be violent. Actually, I could argue it would increase the risk that they would be violent, because typical inpatient forced treatment is inhumane and is experienced as such by people. Remember what I said, one of the risk factors of violence is a feeling of persecution. If one feels persecuted and mistreated, their risk goes up. It doesn't mean they're going to be violent, but their risk of violence goes up. So trying to incarcerate people involuntarily and force drugging them, which is what would happen, or force electroshock therapying them, is not going to do anything but make the situation worse. But the other problem is how you would ever identify people who are going to be violent. Psychologists, any kind of science, is not good at predicting human behavior. The best predictor is past behavior. There are other predictors, but when we put everything together and we try to predict, we're just not good at it. And in fact, there's a problem of screening for people who are possibly violent. In other words, these red flag laws of trying to identify red flags that will point out to us the people we should work with to prevent them from being violent before they're violent, they naturally have a high false positive rate. In any kind of low base rate occurrence, and violence is a low base rate, when you compare the number of people who commit violence to the total population, you get a very small percentage. So it's less than 1% of the population will be violent. That's a very low base rate. And with any low base rate occurrence, even if you have a very accurate way to screen for the people who will be violent, most of the people that you identify will be false positives, meaning they won't be violent. And at that kind of a a base rate, the false positive rate is going to be somewhere around 80 to 90%. So that means if you identify 100 people as needing treatment because you worry they're going to be violent, 80 to 90 of them will never be violent, but yet they'll still be subjected to that coerced treatment.
You know, I keep hearing people in my mind reacting to this saying, but wait a minute, don't dangerous people need to be put away? Don't we need to involuntarily commit them at times?
Well, I might agree with that if we didn't commit them to a hospital. I mean, if we take people who have committed crimes, and we have a society that part of the purpose of having the criminal justice system is to protect the public, and if these people are truly assessed as dangerous, you know, with good psychological science and their past behavior and their current stated desires, if we somehow conclude they are a threat to the public, then they can be locked up in a prison. Putting them in a hospital is silly, because that all that does is it robs someone of due process of law, for one thing, because you don't have to go through court to go into a hospital. You just need someone like me saying they're dangerous. If they are dangerous to society, we need to put them in a prison or some other place like that.
Wouldn't we try to help them, though, by putting them in a hospital? Isn't that what they need, is help, not to be criminalized?
No, you cannot coercively treat someone for being violent. It's not going to work. The only way so-called mental health treatment works is when the person being treated wants the help. You can't show me any other kind of involuntary coerced treatment within the mental health industry where it's been effective. The only effectiveness, if you want to call it this, is you can lock them up in a mental hospital, just like you would in a prison. But there's no treatment that goes on in those hospitals. There is treatment, drugs are administered, but it's not effective. It doesn't do anything to help society. That's my point.
It calms them for the moment, but doesn't deal with the root cause. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not even sure it calms them for the moment. It sedates them, and it gets them really angry and feeling mistreated while they're in there. But once you release them, nothing has changed other than now they're even more upset about the world. So you can't release them. They end up staying in the hospital indefinitely. In a prison, that... locking someone up for the purpose of protecting society is not the business of the mental health industry. It's the business of the criminal justice system.
If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Dr. Chuck Ruby, Executive Director of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry. How do we help people who are really troubled, you know, experiencing mental distress? Some of these young white men that we see who've become who turn into these mass shooters. How, what, if it's not drugs and it's not hospitalization, how are there alternatives out there for these young men, ways we could catch them before they become what they do?
Yeah, there's two ways to do this. The one way is if we look at the individual and we offer assistance to them. And I mean offer it and honestly portray it as assistance to help them find a way to deal with the emotional turmoil that is the trigger for these acts.
And what do those treatments look like?
The general talk therapy kinds of things. You're saying treatment, I'm saying treatment too, but it's really misleading. It's not something, psychotherapy, counseling is not something you do to a person. It's not like a hypnotizing-like process where the person comes in and the expert psychologist makes them different. That is just not how it works. The way effective psychotherapy works is when the person truly desires some kind of significant change in their life, and then the therapist assists them in that change. It's an ongoing, painstaking, explorative kind of a process. It does not happen in a manualized, agenda-driven fashion. Any kind of success we see in that kind of treatment, a manualized, agenda-driven, time-limited fashion, is short-lived. It's very superficial. It never addresses fundamental things going on in the person's meaning systems that will affect change. Now, that's one way to assist. Those things are already available to people, but it's a crapshoot. It depends on who you get as a therapist as to whether you'll get that kind of assistance. The other thing, and more effective would be, is to pay attention to some societal factors that we have going on that lead to these kinds of emotional turmoil in people, especially as they get out of high school, which is like the big risky time is late high school, early adulthood, when these things occur. So how people are treated in school is one way. What school is. I mean, these are grand issues, and they're not going to get changed easily. But we can't ignore the fact that when people react like they do with these mass shootings, they're not crazy in the sense that the shooting doesn't make any sense. It always makes sense. We may not agree with it, obviously, and we may not want it to happen. It's very dangerous. But it's a reflection of some larger societal problems going on, at least within that person's sub-society.
Right. It doesn't make sense to us on the outside in any way, shape, or form. But you're saying in that person's limited world of options, somehow it makes, there's a logic behind their thinking.
Absolutely.
As crazy as it is to the rest of us.
Right. You know, and it's interesting because the whole mental health industry is based on this idea that when we don't understand behavior, someone's behavior, we make up a reason, and we call it mental illness and crazy, and not right in the head, those kinds of things. But that does not explain anything. It's just name calling. And the same thing occurred centuries ago when strange behavior was considered caused by demon possession and evil spirits and witchcraft. It does the same thing. It has no scientific foundation to it. Mental illness doesn't, not to the idea of illness. But we use those labels to pin on someone whose behavior we don't understand. And then we think we've done something about it, and we haven't.
And so you're saying that actually you do believe that some of these individuals could be helped. I mean, if somehow we could intervene in their faulty logic before it gets fully out of control.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it's faulty logic, but intervene in their logic, yes.
I'm sorry, faulty logic to us.
Yeah, I'd like to think I've helped some of those people, but how do I determine that? Because they never did any shooting. But would they have if I wasn't in their life? That's a big question. But I'd like to think I did, because I know I have worked with young people who were very, very upset about how they'd been treated by a lot of different people, who had violent thoughts, and they never did end up hurting anyone. They found a way to get along in society and find some kind of life satisfaction despite all of that.
So do you think this could be rooted in an extreme sense of powerlessness? I mean, obviously, it's such a huge overcompensation, but what do you attribute this, you know, how should I say? I know I'm saying faulty logic to the rest of us, but their logic that follows this extremely violent means of expression. I mean, what would you say in your experience of encountering distressed people would be the root? How do we get to that point? Where do we start from, and how do we build to that level of desire to create that much damage to the human race?
I don't think it's as strange as you're portraying it to be. I know it's violent, and again, I don't want to minimize any of these shootings, but the rationale that people use, the logic, I don't think it's as bizarre as most people think. The behavior is bizarre in that it's very atypical and damaging, but the reasoning to get there isn't. It's no different than the reasoning that most of us go through when we get angry. It's a heightened form, yes. And I'm not saying there's no equivalency here, but the basic reasoning and what anger does to us, why it's there, how it functions, and what we do about it is the same. It's just that those people who end up shooting up the place have no outlet before they get to that point, or for whatever reason they are more impulsive than another person. But it's not as bizarre as it's being portrayed, especially in the media. and in popular minds.
Yeah, it's sort of hard for us to imagine that, but
It's hard. It's comforting for us to think that those are abnormal people and we're the normal people, and that would never happen to me until it happens to you. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wow, I can see how that can happen. I think all of us have done things, not like that, but have done things that we thought we'd never do, and we feel very remorseful about it. You know, how did that ever happen? Whether we were, you know, drinking at the time, or, you know, suffering the loss of the death of somebody, or we've done things that we never thought we would do. So again, I'm trying to clear up this, what appears to be this assumed distinction between abnormal and normal people, or what that really means is immoral and moral people. And we don't have time to get into that, but this difference that it's them and us.
Right.
And so, they're the bad guys and we're the good guys. And that's just not the way the world works.
If I'm understanding you correctly, it's something like you're saying that it's human behavior in the wrong hands, or given the wrong resources, are not enough to provide support or whatever else they might need. Just kind of goes awry. Human nature in and of itself, human tendency that goes awry because there just isn't any kind of support that's providing other options. It's almost like getting angry on steroids. I mean, and that's not even the right exaggeration. It's beyond steroids, right? And getting angry on steroids to the max. I mean, exponentially.
Right. If you understand the function of anger in human evolution, anger is the thing that helps us. So in the past, when you were being chased by a lion across the savannas of Africa, it was a good idea to get angry. It was survival was best when you were angry. Unfortunately, we have that evolutionary holdover still. We're not being chased usually by predatory animals, and we're not being threatened by rival tribes or anything like that. But still, anger is with us, and it happens automatically when we are in too much emotional pain. And the purpose is for us to get rid of that painful feeling and take on a very offensive and powerful feeling. And it does have survival benefit. The problem is, as I said, when that happens these days, usually it ends up turning into crime.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I'm reflecting on, I've been researching World War II and the Nazis, and the fact that they were, a lot of the soldiers were on amphetamines, and they were some of the first soldiers to experiment with amphetamines, and that allowed them to be more aggressive and more, to do their job as soldiers. I mean...
Yeah. That's happening in the military today. There are sometimes amphetamines given to, you know, usually or ostensibly to keep people awake in times of combat, but it does have other effects. Think about how we respond to war. So we send our people over and bomb other countries, and that bombing kills horribly, worse than these mass shootings, kills, mutilates, all kinds of people, children, adults, the elderly, and so forth. We don't seem to react the same way to that as we do to these mass shootings. And why is that? It's only because it is legally permissible for us to bomb other countries. It is more, it's considered morally just, depending on, you know, which country you look from. And in fact, our invasion of Panama was called Operation Just Cause. And what did we do? We went in and we kidnapped a president of another country and brought him to our country. But anyways, we look at those kinds of things as okay and moral. But a shooting like this, we look at as immoral. It's not that, you know, the idea that it's a matter of illness, it's more that term mental illness is more of a cover for immoral, because it's all mental illness categories are about inappropriate behavior or experiences. Inappropriate, not ill, not diseased, but inappropriate. And the only way to judge what is appropriate or inappropriate, or right or wrong, or good or bad, is a moral judgment. It's all founded on that. So when we see these mass shootings, we somehow think of them as sick, but we don't really mean disease, because there's no evidence of that. I mean, I'm assuming there's no tumor in the frontal lobe that's causing this, because that will, a tumor in the frontal lobe of the brain will cause one to act very violently. That's not mental illness. That's a neurological illness. But when we look at war and the horrible carnage that we create around the world, we see that as okay. That says something about what's going on here with violence.
Yeah. Do you think these hate groups in some ways are almost like little mini armies, and that's part of what fuels this sense of justice for these mass shooters?
Yes, absolutely. You have to, in order to kill another person, you have to dehumanize them some, somehow, or to some extent, it makes it easier to then justify in your own mind that you just killed them. These hate groups, left and right, whatever kind of group it is, are little armies, and they literally have little armies that they create to go around and do these things in furtherance of a political agenda, and we call that terrorism if it's a non-state actor.
Yeah, it almost seems almost a kind of support group for people who are disenfranchised.
Well, it is. I did some research on psychology of terrorism when I was in the military in the 1990s, and it is interesting how terrorist groups form, what their purpose is, who runs them, and what they offer to people who do feel disenfranchised. They feel disaffected, disenfranchised. They don't feel like they're being listened to, and this is one way for them to be listened to and to be heard, not unlike how a mass shooter does. He doesn't feel listened to, heard, taken seriously, and he's mistreated. And this is a way to say, hey, look at me. You know, I'm taking my revenge against you because you mistreated me. And then the public reacts to that with, well, we should give him a taste of his own medicine and put him up against the firing, a wall and shoot him. But that's the same thing. They're taking revenge against him. He took revenge against who he thought were bad people. And on and on and on that goes, that cycle of violence.
And that returns back to this notion of the mental health system as being adversarial to somebody who's in distress. If they're involuntarily committed, then they could feel, as you said, further persecuted from the system, and why the mental health system may not be working or making it worse.
Well, it's not working because it's a system focused on, or it assumes pathology, and then it goes forward with that assumption, and there's no basis for that assumption.
Do you think it is dehumanizing our people, some of the people it's trying to help?
Oh, absolutely, it's dehumanizing people. It is an inhumane system, the conventional orthodox mental health system. Don't get me wrong, I know a lot of people within the system, and again, I count myself as one of them, but they're very, very respectful of self-determination, autonomy, humanity, that the individual gets to choose the outcome of his life, even if it's a bad outcome, even if he ends up getting arrested for choosing something, that choice is important. That self-determination is important. And so there are many of us in the field that try to, the ICIP's motto is restoring humanity to life. And that's what we try to do. We try to restore a humane version of helping people when they want helped. But we are not in the business. I don't think we should be in the business of helping people, quote unquote, helping people when they don't want the help. But we do that a lot in the industry.
If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Dr. Chuck Ruby, Executive Director of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry. So how can people get a hold of you?
Psychintegrity.org, docruby@me.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, MK, thank you.
Talk to me. Talk to me. Talk to me in your own sweet gentle way. Talk to me. Talk to me.